All right, you guys are listening to Sober Life Radio, and that was Cushion Revolution by The Deathless. We were playing that song this morning because the man that you hear doing the spoken word over that is Noah Levine, and he's going to be our guest on our show today.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so stay tuned. We'll have him coming on shortly. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning. It's good to be back. How's everything going with you?
Things are good. I know we missed you last week.
I know. I was at my nephew's funeral. Who was killed in a car accident. He was in the back seat. The driver was obviously intoxicated, but I was at a funeral. It had literally thousands of people, including the mayor, two senators, police. He was a street kid out of Albany, and he used to do a lot of tagging and graffiti. And it's funny because all these thousands of street kids came out to support him. So, you know, it's just interesting that we have this culture that we constantly discount in our world that have purpose and a direction. And even the mayor made a moratorium where they couldn't touch his graffiti for 30 days after he died, so people could go out and pay respects and stuff like that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, very interesting city.
You said it was Albany, right?
It was in Albany. Yeah,
man, I'm very sorry to hear about that. It is really cool though that underground culture was honored and represented.
They were honored, right, by state troopers, probation officers. And so funny, people that even own buildings that used to hate him for tagging them came for the funeral.
It's funny because we didn't do this intentionally, but that really ties into the show that we're having today, because now I'm personally a fan of Noah Levine.
Sure.
I've read all of his books. I'm going to sound all fangirl now. I'm a big fan of Refuge Recovery and whatnot, but part of his story, and I'm sure he'll talk about this when he comes on the air, is being that like part of that underground culture in the 80s. And he was known for his tagging and like Santa Cruz and whatnot. And very similar, like a lot of these people that he was involved with, like in institutions and juvenile institutions, they ended up being fans of his.
Right. It's just interesting. It's so funny, because back in the 80s, a friend of mine named Rick Spellman, who was a tattoo artisan, Santa Ana, California. I knew him and his father. And I just remember him tattooing this young 18-year-old Henry Rollins, which is just funny, you know, going over there and just funny. And this is, and like, because that whole thing back then was just growing. That culture was growing. And when they were back there, that's the thing about success. People that get real successful have nothing to do about their ego and anything. They live a life. And it just ends up that way.
Right.
And I think that's what we miss out on. We always try to, we watch our life, we don't live it, you know.
Because a lot of those people, too, they're true to themselves.
Yes.
You know, you say it all the time, be your authentic self.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that we're talking about, they're authentic selves for better or for worse. And
It's a sub, you know. And really, they're not a subculture. And it's interesting when the subculture ends up in the mainstream of people.
Right.
And then everyone wonders, wow, what they were like here all along. No, these are the people you really didn't like and used to make fun of.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Right. Completely. I relate to that all the time.
Right. And it's like, wow, how did they get there? Because now, you know, now the conservative and right wing people look, wow, look at like, you know, Henry Rollins and these people on these shows. It's like, well, no, he started out like in the back of a van traveling around the country.
Yeah. See, I love him, too, as an author.
Yeah.
I've read a bunch of his books. It's funny. It just brought back memories. I remember I was made fun of quite a bit, like middle school and high school, for the way I dressed, the things that I was into. And then fast forward years later in my 20s, some of those same people that were making fun of me were like, oh, I really, you know, I like that tattoo. I like that period. And I'm like, you were such a jerk to me
something.
In school. Why are you kissing my, you know what now? Like,
because they do. Because now it's accepted by, you know, and I always hate that. I always feel that when general society or the general public starts accepting you, well, you've lost it. Like, that's when when tattooing became like, when grandma started getting sleeved, I was like, man, then I started wearing long sleeve shirts. I don't want to be like the rest of you. You know.
Like one Hot Topic.
So right.
I remember being in like, you know, again, like middle school, early high school. And I wearing like stockings on my arms, but I would like cut stockings up or like go to the hardware store and buy chains to like put on my wallet.
Yeah, like real
go
shit.
Go into a pet
like
store and
stuff.
Buying a dog collar because you couldn't
right.
find this in stores. And then, you know, Hot Topic opened up and everyone was like
wearing dog collars.
And I'm like, well,
yeah, the temporary tattoo
anymore.
Stuff. And everybody started getting really tough looking. You know, it's not. Yeah, we sort of lost it. I don't know. It became less cool. I like the still, I like the dirtiness of everything. I like the go, if you have to walk through the front door, then something's wrong. You have to sneak in the back. That's everything. You know, I've been back dooring it for a long.
Yeah, we know. Yeah.
Not. Yeah, I have been. Sorta.
Joel likes the back door.
No. Well, I cry after. So no, it's good to be back. But yeah, so this is going to be interesting today because I spent a lot of time overseas where many people are Buddhist and.
Yeah.
And how they live their life, I always admired. And I always say, how do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you just, you know, not worry? We worry about everything.
Oh, constantly. You get in that loop, excessive worrying. You're worrying about worrying.
Yeah.
You're worrying because you're worrying worrying.
Yeah. And it's like you, but then you forget how to live.
Right.
And these people, like, over there, I just remember, like, I lived with. For a while, Aizu Shirin Bukuru was a grandmaster of Shonro Karate. I was used to write his letters back to the States. He had always had a Marine or somebody there that would correspond with his dojos back in the States. And when, and then he would just give you like little things to do, or he'd give you his lessons for free. And but the way he lived his life, and it was just that he walked everywhere, rode a bicycle everywhere, garden, ate, like dusted off the food, ate it right out of the ground. And he just, and he knew if he was good to everybody, that would just come around.
Right.
Like, he never thought any, he never complained, and he never, like, was cynical, and he never said anything bad about anyone. You could be kicking him in the head, and he wouldn't say anything bad about you, not that you would, but he always believed that good brings good, and.
Right. Well, it's simplicity.
It's simplicity.
We, right. as a culture, we as humans, we overcomplicate things. And you're right. It prevents us from being here in the moment. You know, in that song that we just played, The Cushion Revolution, there's a lyric that's like, be right right now. Right now is like this. And you're I right. love that. Because that's all you have is right now.
Yeah. And just being a living, being authentic and being who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't matter. If no one cares, like, really, if your circle is so small, then that your circle should be. Let me tell you something. You know where your circle should be? You. And then worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it, because when you bring a couple people in your circle, then you start worrying about how they think about you.
Yeah.
And this, and that's terrible.
I agree. You know? Again, keep it simple. And, well, now I'm throwing around.
I know it. Really. Then you're throwing around.
12-step mottos here.
I know. We got to get our own. We need our own stickers. Like, you know, who gives a. But. Lucy's listening in.
Hi, Lucy.
I fit. Well, I just love Lucy. She's made every time I don't even like I tell you what I eat so healthy now just because her I have her in the back of my head, so isn't that funny? And she does that to people, and she has this whole purpose of, you know, changing men.
Oh yeah,
in the vegetarian yeah. to vegan, you know, Vegas, but it's a vegan. I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, she's interesting to follow. I like
yeah, so
her. And we appreciate that she follows us. So
yes.
thanks for listening, Lucy.
I want to well, hope she comes to town soon. I'd like to.
Yeah, we know what you want to do. But...
No, so, Lucy, don't think like that.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be,
for
normally Joel
today.
And I will spend quite a bit of time at the beginning of the show talking and whatnot and just chatting with each other, but we're going to cut it short because we also want to play some more songs from the Deathless while we get Noah Levine hooked up and ready. Like I said, he's going to be tuning in or joining us from California.
Right, wow.
So we're going to spend
but
some
that's
time.
That's early for him, isn't it?
It is early for him.
Well, he's probably
I'm very
up.
Appreciative.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's going to be, it's like 7 o'clock.
Wow. Well, he's up, I'm sure, early.
His time. Yeah. So why don't we go to some music right now? Again, you're going to be listening to The Deathless. They are a Buddhist punk band that Noah Levine is a part of. So enjoy, listen to the lyrics if you can. I know it's punk, so if you're not into punk it might be hard for you to follow the lyrics, but listen to the lyrics. It's some good stuff in there. And after the music we will be joined by Noah Levine himself, so stay tuned.
All right, we're back.
All right, so again, if you're just tuning in, this is Sober Life Radio and you were just listening to The Deathless. You heard Adapt and Destroy, Perfect Imperfections, 1985, and what you were just listening to was The Gates to the Deathless Are Open. And we are very fortunate and very excited that we have Noah Levine on the phone right now.
Hey, Noah.
Good morning.
Good morning. So since this is Sober Life Radio, I figured why don't we just chat a little bit about your journey to sobriety. And, you know, I'd love to hear about refuge recovery and how that came about. So I'm just going to kind of hand it over to you and let you take the reins.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Sober life. I've lived more of my life sober than I did, drinking or using or that I was alive. I'm sober for coming up on 29 years, and I got sober when I was 17 years old. And you know what, Brian, I got sober so young, and I think it was definitely the crack cocaine and the heroin, and that really kind of brought me down, all the consequences of my addiction that got me to the place of enough suffering to become willing to seek help at a very young age. So at 17 years old, I was sitting in juvenile hall for more than 10 times as an adolescent, and I was looking at my third felony arrest, and it looked like, that I was heading for a life of imprisonment. And, I had started being sent to 12-step when I was about 13 years old because I got arrested a lot as a kid, and a lot of it was drugs and alcohol related. And so I knew a little bit about recovery. But to me, I can remember my early experience with recovery rooms was, just seeing adults, and that it was something about religion that they were talking about.
Right.
something. Yes. So I was just like, yeah, okay, sign my court card. I got to get out of here. But then, by the time I was 17, I was just desperate and willing to try to do something else. So I was in juvie, and I started going to 12-step, and I actually knew some of the guys that were bringing the meeting into the institution I was incarcerated in. I knew them from the streets, so that helped actually to have a little personal connection and to know that these guys were not just like Bible thumpers or something.
Right.
They were kids like me from the streets, and at the same time, my father introduced me. My father is a Stephen Levine. He's a famous meditation teacher and written all these books. And so I grew up around these Buddhists and meditation people, but I had really rejected it in my punk rock rebellion.
Yep.
as associated with the hippies, and the hippies were the enemy. So
right.
I didn't really know about meditation, but that desperation. At the time, I was like, okay, I'll try anything. I'll go to the meetings. And my dad gave me a simple mindfulness of breath meditation instruction. And then I'd sit in my cell and I'd try to pay attention to my breathing. And it was really the turning point for me where, my whole life I'd been looking for some kind of, satisfaction, some kind of something to ease my suffering, my dissatisfaction. And I had a sense that maybe the community, I was into punk rock because of the music and the rebellion and all of that, but also because in punk rock I found a community, and that was important to me. And so I had a sense that in recovery there was a community, right? Like these guys were saying, like, yeah, we look out for each other, and we have this kind of sober community. And that was attractive. And then in meditation, I had the sense that, here's a powerful tool, something that I can do that will actually give me a little bit of relief.
Right.
And, the relief that I got from drinking and using in the beginning that was no longer working very well, and the consequences were outweighing the relief at that point. And so I being a good addict, I turned that impulsive, compulsive, over the top
right.
tendency. Eventually, right. I turned it towards meditation, and what happened for me was, as I'm pointing to, the philosophy in the 12 steps didn't resonate very well with me. All of the Judeo-Christian language.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
However beautifully open-minded it is around, you know, as you understand him and...
Right, capital H.
Considering
yeah.
they created the programs in the 1930s, like they were so open-minded, but it was still very theistic, and it is very theistic. And I just, it never really made sense to me. This external higher power philosophy never made sense. But in Buddhism, I found this program, you know, this process that said, actually, everything that you're looking for is inside you. It's just buried. It's obscured. And actually, this whole meditation process is about recovering some natural compassion and wisdom that's in there. You just have to train your heart and mind in order to access it, in order to recover it. And so that perspective made much more sense to me. But my dilemma in my, you know, early sober life was I didn't like the Buddhists.
Oh.
I didn't like the people. I didn't like the community. You know, it was like these are my dad's hippie friends.
Right.
And, you know, I like what they're saying. And what they're saying is really like resonating and it's really radical. But it's not my culture. It's not my community. And then in the 12 steps, I was like, actually, here's my people.
Right.
And, you know, these are the people that I want to go to the Motorhead show with.
Right.
But they're not, but I don't actually believe, some of what's being said in this,
yeah.
you know, in this process. So I became very willing and I did my best to do the 12 steps, you know, as thoroughly as I could, and did the prayers and did the inventories and did the amends. And I was very thorough about working the 12 steps, but it was also true to myself for the most part around, a kind of the experiment. I approached theism with an open mind enough to say, like, I'll try and I'll pray and I'll do all of that. And if it comes, you know, if I come to believe, cool. But my own experience was that I never really came to believe that or assign the meaning of the recovery and the transformation that I was having to some sort of outside grace of God or, I always just saw this as very kind of practical. Oh yeah, when I pray, the humility of praying is helpful. And, when I do the inventories and, you know, when I look at it, you know, most of this perspective, it's useful to my own psychology, but I don't assign the meaning to, some sort of mystical external power.
Right.
I saw it much more as a humanist process, and it was always in conjunction with my Buddhist meditation practice. And so I saw, oh, the meditation's helping me be present. It's helping me learn to forgive myself and to forgive others. It's helping me develop compassion for the pain and the trauma that led to my addiction in the first place. And it's helping me, you know, dedicate my life to compassionate engagement and being of service. And so there was so much in common between Buddhism and the 12 steps. And then there were some major philosophical differences. And so I just lived between the two worlds for a long time. And then eventually I said, oh, hey, I started teaching Buddhism. My teachers, Jack Kornfield, mm-hmm. and my father and Ajahn Amaro, these Buddhist teachers, at some point, maybe about 10 years into my recovery and my practice, said, hey, we want you to start teaching. And I started going back into the same juvenile halls that I'd been incarcerated in and going into prisons. And I went back to school. I got my master's degree in psychology, and I did my internship at San Quentin in the prison with the adult inmates. And
that's awesome.
You know, I was teaching them meditation and talking to them about recovery. And and eventually I realized that Buddhism just fit better as a recovery and spiritual path for me than anything that was theistic.
Right.
You know, the kind of Judeo-Christian model just didn't resonate as well. So I created Refuge Recovery. And I created it about 10 years ago. And I'd already written a bunch of books on Buddhism and had, you know, established a big Buddhist community in Los Angeles and San Francisco and New York and all over the country. The Dharma Punks groups were happening. And then Against the Stream And that what we found was that more than half of the people in our Buddhist community were in recovery, were sober. And then there was another, you know, large part of the community who weren't addicts and were coming for other manifestations of suffering.
Right.
So I decided to create Refuge Recovery as a specific way to help the addicts and to address addiction through a Buddhist lens.
So from the beginning, so right now, I mean, because I talk to Carrie about this a lot, because
right.
now it's becoming big on like an underworld scale, right? So things are growing.
You know,
it's very interesting. Like we were talking earlier about this, the whole, you know, punk rock days and how now everybody within that, you know, genre is like older and, you know, writing books and doing things, but it's becoming more mainstream, you know. So it's what was the time when you decided, well, I'm going to reach out and try to spread this word throughout wherever you're doing? Right now it's nationally. But was like, right. did you ever just have a moment to think, wow, this is going somewhere? Because I'd always think, you know, people that are so in Buddhist or even, you know, the subculture doesn't realize a lot of times that they are that popular because you're living a life that just you're just trying to create good for good. And it's this right. is just turning into something huge now. And have you ever right. had that time that, wow, this is like immense, like now I've become like the Bill W. of
right,
the
like with the when you wrote the Dharma
cover.
Yeah.
Like when, like how has there ever been a moment when you think, wow, like this is not, let's say,
yeah, I mean, there.
Go ahead.
There are. I mean, there's lots of those moments where, because, you know, you do something, you know, especially you write a book, and there's always hope that people will read your book.
Right.
And you hope that people will read it. You hope that they will like it. And, of course, all of my books have the core intention that it will help people. So, you know, I write Dharma Punks, and I hope people read this. I hope it helps them, you know, see the connections between punk rock and spiritual awakening. I hope it helps people find recovery that are looking for recovery. And then at some point, years into it, you kind of get enough feedback and enough people say that totally helped me, that yes, I have had that experience over and over with, you know, with the books and with the communities that I've helped to create. And with Refuge Recovery, yeah, it's the same way. You know, I was like, well, I know that this will, there's been some surprising things for me, because for me, I knew in my communities it would be well received. And I also had this sense that, like, on the East Coast and the West Coast, it would be well received, mm-hmm. where there's already kind of a lot of Buddhist, you know, minded people.
Right.
But some of the places where I've been surprised is, like, when I go to Georgia or when I go to, you know, Tennessee, or I go to, you know, some of the places in the South or in the Midwest, and I see, oh, they have 6 Refuge Recovery mm-hmm. meetings. There's more meetings in, you know, in places like Nashville mm-hmm. or in some places like in Alabama than there are in New York City.
Right.
Like New York right. City has like a couple, 2 or 3 Refuge Recovery meetings a week. And there's places in the South where they have like 6 or 7. And the program is more thriving on some level in some of the Bible Belt places.
Wow.
Because of the oppression in the Bible Belt
yeah.
and the kind of, the 12 steps are so close to the philosophy that so many of these people felt traumatized by in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're really seeking an alternative to that, you know, Christian language. And so the Buddhist language is fitting better for a lot of addicts seeking recovery. And, so I totally have that experience of just like, oh, wow, this is cool. This is amazing. You know, it went from, you know, 2.5 years ago when I wrote, when the book came out, when Refuge came out, there was like 10 Refuge Recovery meetings mm-hmm. before the book even came out, just in my community. And now there's close to 300. And so like every couple of months looking at, oh, well, okay, there's 10 more meetings, and every week there's new meetings mm-hmm. starting, and just seeing, and I still have this sense of like, okay, well, let's see where it's at in 10 or 20 years.
Right.
Because, you know, some of the meetings that will start won't sustain. You know, there'll be an initial excitement. And then let's see, you know, can this become a thing where, you know, it's a viable support for people in most places? It's still looking like it's mostly kind of urban places, you know, the kind of the small town in, you know, in rural America might not have enough people that are open to, you know, are interested in Buddhism to really support a meeting. But in most cities that meetings get started in, they go pretty well.
Ours have been going great. I mean, we started one here in November, and I mean, I personally, again, I bought the book when it came out, and I always kind of identify myself as a little bit of an outcast in the recovery community because I, you know, similar to what you were saying, it just never vibed with 12-step programs for various reasons. So when this came out, I was very excited about it, but not a lot of people knew what I was talking about when I would talk about, you know, like refuge recovery or, you know, even Buddhism. So a couple of my friends and I decided to start a meeting up here, and the response has been overwhelming. I mean, every week more and more people are showing up and people are sharing more about how, like, you know, they feel more comfortable kind of stepping outside of this box that they've been put into for whatever reason. And it's just great.
Right.
So, you know, I just personally want to say thank you for creating this program and writing this book and giving people, you know, an alternative. Because, you know, Joel and I always say there is no right way to recover per se.
Right.
Thank you for another option for people.
And it's been wonderful. Like, you know, it gives a kid with a Black Flag t-shirt a place to go, we always say. But
But also, like, I've been surprised on how, you know, not only has it been an alternative for people who, you know, don't resonate so well with the 12 steps, it's also been this bridge back to 12-step fellowship for a lot of people.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And that was a little bit surprising for me. You know, there was a lot of people that felt like if they had to go to the 12 steps and they were kind of, that was, they were told this is the only thing and you have to believe this and it's the only thing that will work. But then they found refuge and they said, oh, here's a whole nother way that is, has, you know, so much in common. And, now that I have that, now I can go to meetings, to 12 step meetings and feel more comfortable because I have a philosophy that works for me.
You're spot on because I'm like one of the only people in that goes to our Rochester meeting that doesn't do 12-step program. Everyone else, for the most part, they're in, you know, 12-step program, and it's opened my eyes even in, you know, to, you know, even the thoughts of like dipping back into that community, that world. So good point.
Yeah. Another thing too, it's very interesting. Before we came on, our sound person, we talked about he actually read one of your books after he lost an election, and it actually a friend of his gave it to him. So is this very interesting? And he's someone that's not in recovery, but was this even your work is like spilling over into the regular community that is suffering or just wants something to feel better about?
In the beginning, I didn't want to be the recovery guy because I didn't want to exclude non-addicts from the Buddhist teachings, because the Buddhist teachings apply to all of us. They, you know, because everyone, whether your suffering manifests as an addictive behavior, everybody has craving and everybody has aversion and everybody has the core seeds of suffering in them. And so it applies to all of us.
Absolutely. Now, one of the questions I had for you is, you know, what is a day in the life like for you? I know that you've gone through a lot of changes, a lot of things have happened for you this past year or so in particular. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, a day in the life, you know, depends on what day of the week. Yesterday I spent most of the day at my treatment center, you know, as well as starting the program, I also opened an addiction treatment center in Los Angeles with a detox and residential and sober living outpatient whole thing.
That's awesome.
And, you know, to really provide this refuge recovery model in a professional setting for people who are seeking treatment. And so, you know, yesterday I spent most of the day down there and, you know, just kind of meeting with the clinicians and, you know, looking at the treatment plans for the clients and, you know, marketing strategies and all that stuff. And then actually I spent the second half of the day in EMDR training because I'm also a clinician. And we use, you know, EMDR, eye movement desensitization training to, you know, treat the trauma that almost all of the addicts come in with some underlying trauma. And so we use EMDR as a core treatment in our program. So I was doing phase two of my EMDR training a lot of the day. And then, you know, I came home and put my kids to bed. And, you know, so it was one of those days. And then, you know, I spend a lot of time traveling and teaching Buddhism and promoting and, you know, educating people about EMDR. About refuge recovery and, you know, being on the road doing that, speaking at conferences or Buddhist centers or, I've been doing this Wanderlust Yoga Festival where I travel around the country and teach meditation as part of this day-long mindful triathlon where we start with a 5K run and then we do yoga for an hour and a half and then we do a 30-minute meditation.
Wow.
And it's so cool because it's like anywhere from, you know, a couple of thousand to 10,000 people come. Wow. And 95% of them stay and meditate in this, you know, big open meditation that I get to lead. So that's been a really fun thing that I've been doing. Mm-hmm. And my life, you know, has changed a lot this last year, having been divorced and being, you know, a single parent with 50-50 custody. So, you know, if I'm not on the road teaching, I'm home with my kids. And if I'm home with my kids, you know, I'm at the office at the treatment center or the meditation center. You know, I have three nonprofits that I run, really. I run the refugerecovery.org, the meetings nonprofit. I run the Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society, which is our meditation centers in Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York. And so I run that. I run the Mind Body Awareness Project, which is the mindfulness programs that go into juvenile halls in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then I run the treatment center as well. So I have my hands full.
Yeah, sounds, I would say so.
You know, when I say run, you know, really, I mean, I started all these organizations. And really, I have a great team of people that run everything. But I'm involved with all three of them, or all four of them.
Are you able to, on a daily basis, incorporate meditation? Like, do you do a sitting practice? Or is it?
I get to do my own practice, and I, you know, make sure to go on retreat every year, and you know, I stay close to it, and I'm also in the fortunate place where it's also my it's my life and it's my livelihood, so I'm always, you know, teaching and practicing and staying in the center of what we call the Dharma, you know, the Buddhist practice. Yeah.
Wow.
So with everything that you've gone through, you mentioned the divorce and you lost your father. How did you incorporate, you know, what you've learned as far as, you know, your Buddhist practices or what you've developed with refuge? How did you carry that over into dealing with these situations? Because those are tough situations to deal with, to say the least.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the practices that we do in recovery or, you know, spiritual practices, they're preparation. You know, like learning to sit still and be in pain. You know, so often people are like, well, why would I want to meditate? Like, that hurts. You have to sit still.
Right.
My mind is loud.
I know that.
But all of that is preparation, right? It's changing our relationship to pain. It's changing our relationship, developing compassion for pain through doing the sitting practice, through, you know, that it's actually a skill we develop. Developing our insight and our understanding and coming into more harmony with impermanence. It's all preparation for the death, the divorces, the, you know, the big changes, the losses, the, you know, political upheaval that's happening currently for, you know, some people suffering so much about the new president, some right. people, you know, so, you know, just all of the stuff that's happening. And my sense is that spiritual practice is preparation for that, and then it's also wise response. And so what I saw, like when my marriage dissolved, when my father died, also a very close friend died, you know, all around the same time last year. And what I saw was like, oh, okay, you know, almost 30 years of meditation practice has given me the ability to understand impermanence and loss in a way that without all of this recovery and meditation, I would feel probably really thrown off center by all of this.
Right.
But my practice let me in a place where it's like, oh, no, this is unpleasant. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, stressful. There's, you know, sadness and grief. But mostly left me with the appropriate emotional response and not the, I'm a victim, this shouldn't be happening,
right.
I'm mad. You know, like I didn't have that extra layer of suffering that we often lay on top of difficult circumstances.
Right.
Because I've been, you know, because I have been training my mind for so long to meet pain with compassion and to meet impermanence and change with an acceptance and a, you know, which doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt. It just means like, okay, this is an ouch and I know how to respond to an ouch, which is to care about it and to, you know, tend to it and to pay attention to it and to feel the emotion without, you know, just needing to avoid it or ignore it or suppress it.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Wow. I totally just lost what I was going to say like there. I know.
Because we're all caught up in this.
But no, what's cool about this is, you know, sometimes, especially on the show and whatnot too, I'll have all of these things that I want to say in advance, but you know, with you, I'm just listening to what you're saying and I'm letting it sink in as if I, you know, like I would be when I'm reading your books and whatnot. So, you know, personally for me, I'm just kind of like, it's neat for me actually talking to you in person. So I'm just letting it sink in.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, that's a problem when you're too mindful, right? And you're not using your planning mind.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I'm so present. I have no idea what
I'm just so I'm just so in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's it because I'm watching Carrie. I'm starstruck right now. But yeah, because I did it. I mean, because I'm the worst, you know, I'm the worst advice giver for myself. You know, obviously, I run a treatment center too, and it's, you know, and I constantly, there's always, you know, the things and that go on during a day, and it's, you know, there is a lot of planning, and sometimes when I'm trying to live my life, like when I'm out running or, you know, just spending time with my children, because it's the same thing. I have to try to remove myself from all that planning mind, and then just be in the moment. Sometimes I find it hard,
yeah.
And I can say it to people, well, this is what you should do, but when I'm, you know, driving home or I'm out on a run and I'm still thinking about all the meetings that morning or the groups or the patients, and it's like, wow, I got to get out of this head for a second. And it's difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's so much of what meditation gives us is that, you know, the mind wants to plan all by itself all of the time. And then, you know, the more we meditate, the more we see, that's a useful function of the mind. But we need to have some agency over when we are doing that because, or else it just takes over our whole life.
Yes.
And, you know, when we're able to just let it be in the background. And one of the big things about meditation that I think people sometimes don't understand is that it's not about stopping your mind from doing those things. It's about learning to ignore it in the beginning.
Right.
And then just have an agency and a choice about, is it time for planning or is it time for just being present? And, you know, one of the things about, you know, setting aside the meditation time each day is saying like, okay, this is not time for planning.
Right.
You know, and this is not time for rehashing the past or, you know, like I can do that with my psychotherapist. I'm in meditation. I can just train my mind to be here. Even though my mind's going to keep thinking about work or relationship or whatever it is, I can keep bringing my attention. We can actually choose what we pay attention to. And so sometimes I talk about that you know, part of recovery is breaking our addiction to the substances or behaviors. And then maybe advanced recovery is breaking our addiction to our own mind. We're so addicted to our thoughts and so identified, that, you know, learning to have a healthier relationship. And then so then that, it's not like abstinence. It's not like the alcoholic who can just never drink again. It's more like the food addict.
Right.
Who says, you know, I can't never think again. I have to find a healthy relationship to food. You know, food is necessary and useful, and, you know, thinking is necessary and useful, but not when you're addicted to it. You know, then it actually creates suffering in your life.
Right. Speaking of meditation, a question that not only I have, but some other people have wanted me to ask you. Now, with the refuge, the meditations, they're guided meditations. What are your thoughts on Zen meditation versus guided meditations? I mean, do you have? I mean, is your preference guided naturally, or?
Well, you know, yes, of course, I have a bias and a preference towards giving, you know, having really good direction mm-hmm. and instructions, and actually teaching people what to do and how to relate to their
right.
minds. You know, some of the stuff I was just saying.
Yeah.
About, you know, when to ignore your mind and when to investigate it and when to use it. And Zen gives some instructions, but most of the Zen meditation instructions are a bit more on the form of, like, you know, sit this way.
Yes.
And then pay attention. But even just that instruction on the posture that they give you, the awareness that you have to bring into the present moment in order to maintain that posture mm-hmm. is the practice.
Right.
Right. So it is actually, they're not, you know, so much giving you the guidance of, like, oh, and come back to the posture, but you just, you know, that's the instruction that's given in the beginning. And then,
right.
you know, you sit there in Zazen for 20 or 30 minutes
mm-hmm.
and, you know, traditionally, if you lost your posture, they'd come around with a stick
yes.
and give you a tap.
Yep.
And say, you know, and that was, you know, traditional guided Zen meditation is a, you know, getting hit with a stick.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. That's the guidance. Hey, you lost your posture. Sit up straight.
And it's funny because that's what I'm used to. And, like, where we have our meeting
yeah.
is at a Zen center. But I really enjoy the guided meditations. And that's one of the things that myself and a few other people are frequently talking about is, you know, Zen versus guided. And we have our own, like, debates back and forth. And I'm tending to lean towards the guided. I like the guided meditations. It's very helpful for me. And obviously everyone has their own
right.
different bias, like you said. But I was just curious as to what your thoughts were.
I got a couple of senses about that. One is that the Buddha gave a lot of meditation instructions.
Okay.
And, you know, so we are actually utilizing, you know, this is what kind of when the Buddha said, here's the map to liberation,
mm-hmm.
here's the map to recovering your Buddha nature. He gave a whole bunch of techniques. Now, Zen was a rebellion against what had happened, you know, in the 1,000 years or so before, you know, between the Buddha's life and when Buddhism got to Japan. And the religion had become so ritualized and dogmatic. And Zen was saying, like, hey, let's keep this simple.
Right.
The guy said meditate. Let's just sit here and meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quite like the spirit of Zen, which is rejecting some of the religiosity of Buddhism and the, you know, some of the dogmatic,
mm-hmm.
You know, ritualized practices. And so they said, just sit. Now, as you know, it became just sit, but sit in the right way and wear the right clothes and
right.
walk in the right way. Don't step on the, you know, the door stop and, you know,
yeah.
bow in the right way. And so it became what it was rejecting, in my opinion. You know, it,
yeah.
it's kind of like most things do.
Right, right.
right.
Like, just like punk rock did, right? Like,
yeah.
punk rock was rejecting mainstream music and
right.
then it became mainstream music.
That's right. That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so
yes.
much. I mean, I've really enjoyed talking to you, and there's so many things I want to ask you, and obviously we just don't have time for that, but thank you so much.
Yeah, and
yeah, really, really happy to be on there, and I'm happy that people are knowing about Refuge Recovery, and I hope that it continues to spread. And I'm happy to be back on the show another time if you guys have more stuff you'd like to chat about.
Sure, and if you're ever in town, if you come this way.
Yeah, if you're ever in Rochester,
if you're in
New
Rochester,
York, you know.
Well, if it builds, well, obviously, if Refuge Recovery becomes huge here, maybe we could get you and sponsor.
Yeah, and, you know, we're doing Refuge conferences now. So we've been doing them in California. I'm doing one in Texas, like a South you know, Southern American States refuge kind of conference thing.
Yeah.
And at some point, you know, we'll have East Coast and we'll have Northeast, you know, refuge conferences, and then we can all, you know, bring all of the different groups together and
sure.
connect.
That'd be awesome. Wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And
my pleasure. Thank you.
Carrie won't
be
able to sleep
touch.
Tonight. So.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thanks,
you. Noah.
Thanks, Carrie.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right.
Wow, that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's funny because my mind, I'm just like thinking of all these things that I like still want to ask. And I just, he's a good guy to talk to.
Yeah. You're glowing.
Am
right,
I?
Yes. You're glowing now. Was that the first time you actually talked to him?
I have been communicating with him through Facebook messages and whatnot. But that's the first time I've talked to him.
Yeah.
You know, voice to voice.
Very, very interesting guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I mean, and that's, it's so funny because, I mean, if you listen to him, he's so humble. And because this is a major person. I mean, this isn't like someone small. This is a movement that's just growing and growing and growing. That's what I was trying to get at, was like, I don't even think he realizes it sometimes, or maybe he does, and then you're in shock.
He is very humble, and he's another person. You know, we experienced this with Brandon Novak,
yes,
in the past. But you know, as I've said, I'm personally a fan of Noah Levine and his work. And once we started the refuge meeting here in Rochester, I started thinking, you know, I wonder if he would ever be on our show. And again, I doubted myself, and I'm thinking he would never, like, he's too big, or he's
right.
You know, I won't be able to get a hold of him. And I did get a hold of him, and immediately, like, I'm talking about within a minute and a half, maybe, he responded to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course my heart started racing. I'm like, oh my God, he's responding to me.
Right.
And it wasn't even the very first words he wrote back to me were, sure, I'd love to. No
yeah.
questions, no talk about, well, you know, there's a fee for me to speak. None
yeah,
of
like
that
my
stuff.
People talk to your people.
No,
like,
he was like,
right.
sure. And then I gave him the information.
Because that's an authentic person. They
yeah.
don't have all that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, is that hard to get to? No, it's not. Start it today.
Mm-hmm.
Start being yourself today.
Well, that's the thing. It's a process. You
yeah.
know, I constantly hear people say, especially in terms of like Buddhism, like, oh, I want to be this enlightened person, and that just doesn't happen.
No.
And it's like a constant process and a journey. And you know, I like that Noah was willing to mention, you know, the divorce and the loss that he's
yeah.
experienced, because these things happen. You
right.
know, you're not on this, as he would say, like this pink cloud forever.
Right.
You know, there is no magic hill. You're not sitting there, you know, because you're meditating and everything's like all
everything's
happy, joyous,
wonderful.
My life is perfect, I'm, you know, this enlightened being. You're still
no.
human. And
I remember watching a interview with the Dalai Lama, and someone said to him, isn't, you know, how's it feel to be like this very spiritual person? He goes, today I have a cold. It's like, obviously,
right.
if I could do so many things, this cold wouldn't be here, but I have a cold today. And it's, you know, it brought a little more humanistic view to things. But
yeah. You know, and I had initially reserved some time at the end of the show to play the last track from the Deathless album, which is called Defy the Lies, which
he
is more like a spoken word.
And he's saying he could do it because we got shortchanged early on. So we're
yeah,
gonna,
I mean, it's like 6.5 minutes. We'll go do it? Okay.
Yeah,
so we're going to close with that. The this is called Defy the Lies. It's spoken word by Noah Levine from the band The Deathless.
See you next week, everybody.
See you next week.